radio 212. Contact.
DPS.
Go.
Inco.
Go.
PUS.
Go.
Surgeon.
Go.
Booster.
Go.
Copy that. We have a go from you guys.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to the official beginning of Season 6 of the Talking Sound Podcast. I want to thank everybody who's been tuning in since Episode 1, people like Joshua Cota, who were actually techs on the show whenever we were doing full live video all the time, everything else. Ryan Hansel, those guys, they've listened the whole time. I know we have quite a bit of audience that has. Thank you all for all of your support over the years. If you would like to continue supporting us and you want to maybe start a podcast, don't forget to go on by podcastcadet.com. That is where you can get all the help you need to start a podcast, everything from branding to editing to like personal one-on-one advice is what they basically provide. You get a podcast consultant assigned to you for everything from social media marketing, all kinds of stuff. Use the code TALKINGSOUND20 on checkout, and you will save 20% on your cart. Once again, that is podcastcadets.com. The code is TALKINGSOUND20. I am so happy to announce our guest today. Absolute amazing musician. The incredible Eric Levy is joining us. He is the keyboardist and synthesizer and piano player and background vocalist for the incredible Night Ranger since 2011. Welcome to the show, Eric. How are you today?
Thanks so much for having me on the show, Chris. I'm doing great. How about you?
Doing great, man. Doing great. You actively just got off tour recently, correct?
Yes, Night Ranger pretty much goes year round. So even in this is kind of the slower part of the year, being January.
Kind of
getting ready to ramp up as spring and summer approach. But even in January, I think we have three shows this month, and had I want to say five shows in December. So even though it's slowed down, we're still getting out and playing music together. But yeah, we got a little bit of a break right now. Our last show was November 28th, I think it was.
Oh wow.
In Las Vegas.
That
27th, somewhere around there.
That is where I am coming
went
from.
Over Nevada in a couple weeks.
Oh, really? I love Vegas. It's probably my favorite city to travel to and work in America. And I really think it's because as a live audio video engineer, it's the fact of I look around and I just see work. I feel the comfort of the fact that I could move here and just get work. I wouldn't have to like go through a lot of effort. You know, you'd either have to be really bad at your job or a really horrible human being for people not to hire you here. Everywhere has about three or four or five theaters. Stuff like that, you know, there's convention centers everywhere. And it's reassuring for me. And it must be so as a musician as well, to know that there's always a gig in Vegas.
Definitely. Yeah. Very, very good lifelong friend of mine, Jacoba Griffin is his name. And, he's a drummer. We worked on when we were first starting our careers, we worked together on a cruise ship, out in doing cruises to the Bahamas from Florida, and from there he ended up moving out to Vegas, and I ended up moving out to California, the Bay Area. But it's great. Like usually when I'm in Vegas, I'll go visit with him and see his shows, get a chance to meet some of the musicians in town. And yeah, there's some great players, absolutely great players in Vegas who really just don't need to travel anywhere because there's so much going on right there. They can just be playing music all the time and stay put where they are.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
Quite a remarkable city. And getting a chance to go in there too, with Night Ranger, there's no other city quite like it, because for a lot of cities, it's like, we don't want to oversaturate. We'll go and play and then our management will decide when the next appropriate time is to come in. But well, with Vegas, it's totally different because it's so easy for people to fly in from anywhere and get a hotel. So we end up playing Vegas more than we play anywhere else.
Well, yeah, yeah, because it is definitely a point of, you know, you don't want to hit Boston twice in a year. You may not even want to hit Boston every year, you know. As much as you guys tour, you really do want to kind of spread it around. But it is one of those, you could absolutely travel all around and just hit Vegas every 3 or 4 months and play a different venue, you know. God, I can't remember how long John Fogerty was here. And I'm at the Palazzo right now. And I can't remember.
Sure, yeah.
Like, Styx was here for a good 3 or 4 months. I know John Fogerty had a long run here and then went next door to the Wind for quite a little while. It's just one of those, you can just make the rounds all around the strip and outside of it. You know, it's amazing. What was it that first brought you into music, Eric? Every story has a beginning, and to end up with Night Ranger, you know, such a seminal band, when it comes to the ballad style of music, rock ballads, things like that. What were your beginnings? Where did you start playing music? What was it that got you interested?
Well, my parents, really, it started with my parents. My dad was a touring musician, back in the 70s. There used to be a circuit for bands where a band could go out and play at like a Holiday Inn somewhere for a week or two, and then like drive down to the next city where that might be, wherever that might be, and go play for another week or two. So yeah, my father was part of that scene, and he was really a saxophonist, but being a horn player in bands, he had enough skill to be able to play piano and a little guitar and bass and percussion, and enough to make himself useful when he wasn't playing sax solos. So I got to grow up with instruments all over the house. And when I was 6 years old, my dad got off the road and started working at a music store. And even though he was really a saxophone player, he ended up getting in the keyboard department because he was kind of into programming, and it just kind of took to it.
Okay.
And so for me growing up, it was amazing because he would just be periodically like bringing home whatever the latest, greatest keyboard was that was out. And, you know, like, here, play with this for the weekend. So, I had an incredible opportunity when I was a kid to really have a chance to play these instruments. And my mom, to her credit, I think she was really, really smart about it, because I wasn't all that terribly interested when I was a kid in playing what I was supposed to be learning for my lessons. But what I was really into was trying to figure out how to play songs that I had heard, or, you know, sitting around like, oh, can I play the theme from Superman or whatever? I was a little kid. So my mom set up this thing where she's like, okay, you have to practice a half hour a day, but for the first 25 minutes, practice what your teacher assigned. And for your last 5 minutes, you can have free time and play whatever you want. And so inevitably I would always end up sitting there for more than a half hour because, you know, I finally getting to the free time. That's what I really wanted to do. So yeah, I think my mom's strategy worked for me there, but growing up, I didn't realize I wanted to have a career in music until my senior year of high school. I was actually planning to, I wanted to go be a computer programmer.
Oh, really?
And, I was way into it. I had a Apple IIe back in the day. And I would sit around with like Compute Magazine and like programming BASIC and DOS and all. Back in the day, I was into it.
That explains a lot about your just passionate love for synthesizers.
Right on.
And that explains a lot to me.
Working it all ties together.
Yeah.
So my senior year, I ended up, guitar player who my father was playing with at the time, this guy Keith Grant, got a gig as a music director for an Elvis impersonator in Chicago, and Joe Salozzi is his name. So he was putting together a band for him, and he decided to see if both me and my dad wanted to be in this band. So my first working band, it was senior year of high school. Here I was going to classes and playing music. And it was like, that's when it kind of clicked with me. Like, wait a second. Like, my life could be this. I could do this as a job. And like, this could be my life. That sounds pretty fun. So that's when I kind of made the decision, like, all right, I'm not going to go to school for computers. I'll go to college and study music. That's how things got started.
Yeah. Yeah. And I always love hearing, like you said, you started off in a path to computers, you know, something that totally different than music. And I love hearing the path that people take to get to their chosen vocation. Because that's really what musician, like engineers, stuff like that. Like, I guess technically I work 12, 15 hour days, but it never feels like work. I love what I do. I'm passionate about what I do, you know, like this is what I've always wanted to do. So why would I be upset about it? Why would I be upset about the process of getting here? What kind of obstacles did you, that was your senior year of high school. How long did it take before things really started getting up and running for you? Because that's something that I always try to give people an understanding of is, you know, you're not just going to put your backpack on with a guitar and walk out and go be a superstar. That's like a movie. Like you're probably going to have like a day job, you know? Like you're going to have to do something to be able to pay the rent, to eat, stuff like that, until you start getting of the caliber that, yeah, you know, you're getting paid a couple $100 a night, $100 a night for your work. And you're out working 3-4 nights a week. What was your path to, I guess, the next level between your first band and your first paying band to kind of hitting that mid tier, you know, where you didn't have the day job anymore, playing music and stuff like that.
I actually never had the closest I've ever had to having a normal job was, for a while when I was in college, I was, DJing once a week at a local bar. And that was as close as I've ever gotten.
Wow. Good for you, man. And that's just it. You know, it's a decision to make it happen and to just make it happen.
I also had advantages.
Sure.
I also had early advantages. So it was, my dad getting me in with that Elvis band.
Yeah.
The next year when I went off to college, I grew up in the Chicago suburbs, and I went to school at Northern Illinois University, which is only an hour from Chicago. Mm. And it was an hour and 15 minutes from where I grew up. So, for the most part, my entire time of college, I was coming back home on the weekends and playing gigs in bars and weddings and whatever I was getting called for. The music director from the Elvis thing actually ended up joining, this band, called Burnt Toast. And it's a burnt, and I loved it. And still, I can't help but smile when I even say the name.
That's a great band name.
Oh, sure. I love talking about Burnt Toast. Yes. I probably won't get anybody into trouble by saying this because it was, oh, no, I shouldn't say it.
Don't say it. If you can't say it, don't say it. Don't say it.
Anyway, suffice it to say, I was still an underage kid.
Sure.
But playing in bars on the weekends and having a blast. And absolutely loved it. Meanwhile, I was going to music school. So my first summer of college, a trumpet player who was in the school with me said, "Hey, I'm from Virginia, and I've been doing this gig over at Busch Gardens theme park in Williamsburg, Virginia, for just a summer job. I've been doing it for years, and they need a piano player this year. Do you want to do it?" And I was like, sure, yeah, that sounds great. So my first two summers of school, I went out and spent the summer at Busch Gardens in Williamsburg, Virginia. And then it's,
wow,
you know, it's so much, I know it, you know, in so many industries it's like this, but especially music, you know, it's really like, you know, you connect with people and you meet people.
Yep.
And then, you know, people who enjoy the way you play and enjoy playing music with you, you know, it's, you get an opportunity down the line and you want to involve people who you like and who you think are going to be right for it. So I ended up meeting this guitar player, Matt Asione, when I was at Busch Gardens, and he ended up getting this gig on a cruise ship, Premier Cruise Lines, no longer around. So he called me up, and the first time he called me to do the gig, I was like, I'm talking to you from my phone in my dorm room at school, and I'm kind of set here for the semester. But it ended up working out where I ended up going out there for a couple summers, and then I left school and for two full years just went and cruised around. And at that point in my life, I was, you know, I just I really didn't have much in the way of ambition yet. I was just like, I wanted to play music and I wanted to get better at music for sure. But I was like, you know, this is the life. I'll just like cruise around the world and I'll see the world and I'll play music and, you know, what could be better? But what eventually ended up having me, bringing me back to Chicago was, that guitar instructor Fareed, called me and said, hey, do you want to join my band? And that was enough for me to come back. What I thought of his playing, I was like, yeah, that's something I should do. So moved back to Chicago. This was, 1998. End of 1998, moved back to Chicago and joined his group. And then in 2000, I noticed all of a sudden one day, like I would show up to play shows with his band. And all of a sudden it wasn't just like the usual, like people, you know, like kind of jazz crowd that I was used to seeing. It was a bunch of young hippie looking people like wearing tie dye. And I was wow, how did this happen? All of a sudden, Fareed's got this whole new audience that's just like, and next thing I knew, Fareed was like, hey, I've been jamming with these guys out in San Francisco, and we need a keyboard player, and you want to do it? So, but before I knew it, I was heading out to California, and the drummer in the band had come off. It was in the jam band scene, and we called the band Garage Mahal.
Oh, okay, and the drummer.
The drummer was this guy Alan Hurst, and he was the one who kind of brought everybody else into the jam band scene. He was the one established jam band guy. And nice. I remember him telling me right off the bat, he's like, just watch what happens. Like before you know it, we're going to be sitting in a van together, driving around the country. Just watch.
Yeah.
And sure enough, by like 2001, like, yeah, I was basically just traveling around the country in a van playing, basically playing jazz fusion music for hippies.
Nice. No, I mean, that's that is what I cut my teeth mixing as an audio engineer, was jam bands. And a lot of people don't like them, but man, if you want to sharpen some skills quick, go work with some jam bands, because you need to learn to read that stage language, you know, those subtle movements between people that trigger the next change for your next effect to be rolled into the soundboard, all kinds of stuff. I've always found them the most fun to mix, because it truly makes me feel like a member of the band. I always say that your audio engineer is a member of the band, because he's playing the most important instrument, the room. he's physically changing the way that the room sounds to accompany your music. So the trust of having a full-time audio engineer is really, really important. And when you're invited to be part of a jam band, it's something different. That means that there is a connection there when you play that does not exist with other people. And that's something really, really, really special, you know?
Yeah, no doubt. There's nothing else like the jam. Yeah. Like the jam band scene. In so many ways, I still miss it. Yeah, the idea that, like, you know, there really aren't wrong notes. I mean, sure, you know, it's like, yeah, depending on the band, you know, you've got parts, and you could, of course,
sure.
But it's like, really, you're there to improvise and improvise, yeah, in the moment, and the rest of the band is a part of it, and whoever's in the audience, in the room, everybody's there, a part of it, and the music is ephemeral. It's like, it's going to sound like that just one time, and everybody who's there to witness it is there.
Yeah.
It's pollination too in that scene. It's just incredible because,
yeah,
it's such an open, like, anybody can sit in with anybody. So
it's,
you end it, up with it, these pretty different styles of music, kind of getting in on each other. So yeah, with Garage Mahal, it's like we started as more of like a jazz fusion, but along the way we ended up incorporating all kinds of stuff that we were hearing from other jam bands, like live techno kind of stuff. We had a bluegrass version of Prince by Prince.
That's it. No, that's like just that. It. When you're a jam band, there is no limit other than the way you're tying the ending chord and a beginning chord together. That's it. Mm-hmm. That's the only limit. Is how are we tying these two songs together? There's no limit as to how you're going to do the song. You could do like a death metal song as a bluegrass jam, you know, like it's amazing. It's so inventive. It's so innovative constantly. And like you said, of a very family ass. I'm sitting here in my hotel room and just noticed I'm actively wearing a Grateful Dead shirt as I say this.
Oh, excellent.
It's one of those. It's a big family of people that play, and it's very incestuous. People jump from band to band to band and all that. The one thing that I really liked hearing you say was before you went on the road with the jam band scene and Garage Mahal, things like that, was that you were a working musician. You went out and you played Elvis in one place. You were out playing hotels. You were out playing cruise ships, all that kind of stuff. And I always try to make the differentiation for people that are looking to get into the industry between artist and musician. I myself am an artist. I have hundreds of hours of music available. Hundreds. It's all free. I don't care. I don't care if I make penny one with it. I'm like the Grateful Dead. Record it, share it, give it out to people. But musicians, on the other hand, ply their trade and actively go out and work, whether it's teaching music to people during the day, playing in jazz bands at night, playing in country bands on the weekend. They are working musicians. They're applying their trade day in, day out, putting the legwork in and increasing their skill set at the same time so that they're more useful for other shows, for other things, so that, like you said, that opportunity arises. Yes, your father opened the door for you, but these opportunities arise because you put yourself in the challenging situation to put yourself somewhere that you were uncomfortable, learn to play in that situation, and learn to grow from that as a musician. As someone who plies their trade on the daily.
I think you're right. That's a good distinction to make with musicians and artists. And I think I benefited growing up in Chicago, which is there's kind of like a blue collar pride kind of thing. I think it's a, you know, not that it's just Chicago. There are other cities that have that too.
Sure.
Coming up being like a lot of the mentality of Chicago musicians is like, hey, you know, learn every style, learn to read, because if you can cut it with all these different styles, guess what? That means you're going to be able to work more.
That's right. That's
that
right.
More people are going to be able to hire you for different kind of stuff.
Yeah, learn to read a chart. Learn to be ready to step in and just do something.
Absolutely. So yeah, some of my I was ranging. Oh, and these I moved to California in 2002. But in that time span from 99 through, you know, for a few years there, I was just doing whatever all gigs I could play in Chicago, and just being in Chicago, I was actually able to be working 6-7 days a week. I would have different steady gigs at different bars on different nights. And I remember I had for a while I had this like late Monday night starting at 1:45 a.m. and playing until they closed the bar, which would be anywhere from between 3:30 and 4:30 a.m. I would play whatever gig I had on Monday night, and then I would go make the late night gig over there. And yeah, that was my life in Chicago, really just taking all the gigs I could.
Yeah.
But when I started coming out to California, there were definitely things that I was able to learn from the music scene here, because all of a sudden I was coming from Chicago, where it was like, really the mentality was like, you know, what do I have to bring to the gig to be able to pull it off? And I came out to California, and it was way more about like, hey, really get, people are really into like, hey, let me get my personal tone together. Let me really work on my sound and have something unique that I'm going out and doing. That was really eye opening for me, and it's really helped me progress in a direction I'm not sure I would have otherwise if I would have stayed in Chicago.
Yeah. And that's an important thing to realize, is that the culture of playing and the what goes into it is different all over the country. It's very much the same in Austin. Where it's what makes you unique? How do you stand out? What gear are you using? Everything else. It's very much about having a curated image as a musician, as an artist. It's much more about the image of the artist than it is about the working musician.
No doubt. You can show up and play cocktail piano at a restaurant, and you know, just be dressed appropriately and not stink, and you're probably going to be fine.
Yeah. but at the same time, if you're trying to have that extreme curated image of the artist, trying to be signed by a major label and stuff, you may not be going out and playing that jazz piano gig, because that would make people think that that's not what your image is, you know? And it's really strange. At some point, these two worlds kind of start separating. You know, and at what point did those worlds start separating and you become involved with Night Ranger?
Okay. I actually thought of a story when we were having our pre-podcast.
Go ahead.
That it kind of reminded me of like the step before the step that I got into Night Ranger.
So all right.
You said about,
let us know.
Oh, about the ethics of people backing out on a gig at the last minute.
Yeah. So, please go ahead, because that's a big topic on this show.
Hindsight is such an interesting thing. I had I booked a show, and I was the one who booked it. It wasn't a place that we ever normally play. It was up in Eureka, California, which is a few hours drive at least from the Bay Area. It was a bar that I had played at with jam band stuff, and I was playing in a band at the time in the Bay Area, and so I booked this show, and then maybe a week before the show, a few days before the show was, I got a call, and it was to play a gig with the Family Stone. I don't think Sly Stone was involved, but it was Family Stone. Opening for James Brown.
Opening
for James Brown.
Wow.
Playing with the Family Stone. That sounds amazing. I so want to do it, but it was the same night that I had this show booked with a rock band a few hours away, and I was like, you know, I would love to do it, but I can't do it. I'm already committed. And I never got called to play with the Family Stone again, and heard got to play on stage with James Brown.
Yeah.
And the show that we played in Eureka was like, we had maybe 20 people there, maybe. Drove all that way to basically play for the bartenders.
You just, yeah.
The leader of that rock band was a gentleman named Will Ivankovich, who plays, currently plays lead guitar with the Guess Who.
Oh, wow.
And he had hooked up then with Jack Blades of Night Ranger.
Mm.
And so, it's funny how these things work. It's like at the time, yeah, it seemed like, did I make the right choice? But years later, I'm like, yeah, I definitely made the right choice.
Good choice.
So that I had met Jack a few times I was playing at Vintage Church in Santa Rosa. And Will, at the time, was the music director over there. And Jack would come every once in a while and sing with us on a couple Christmases. So I had met him in passing and been on a stage with him, but you know, that was really about it. So April of 2010, I got a call from Will, and he said, "Hey, I'm having a birthday party at my house. Do you want to come?" And I was like, "Yeah, totally. I'll come to your birthday party." And he said, "Just leave in your car." And I was like, "Yeah, okay." So I keyboarded my car, not knowing why, and went and showed up at his party and we're hanging out. And like at some point, Jack Blake showed up and walked up to me and said, "Hey, I'm working on a solo album. I'm wondering if you could play on the track like right now." And I said, "Yeah, totally." So I went back. And Will's house at the time, his Pro Tool studio was literally in his living room. So middle of a party in the living room, I set up my keyboard and learned Jack's song and we recorded it. And as the year progressed, Jack ended up calling me a couple more times to come in and play more of his songs. While Fareed was leaving Garage Mahal, and I had mixed feelings about it, but we were planning to continue into 2011, and so we had one last tour on the book between Christmas and New Year's, just doing a few West Coast shows, and so it was the night before I was leaving to do this last tour, I got a call from Jack, and he said, "Hey, so Night Ranger's keyboard player is leaving the band and we're about to record a new studio album. And then we're going to go on a world tour with Journey. Are you interested?" And I said, "Yes, I'm interested. I've got 1 week of shows on the books and then I'm home." And yes, definitely interested. So I ended up going on iTunes that night. This was back in the iPod days.
Yeah.
So I went on my iPod.
Just
and
I buy every Night Ranger song and download them.
I know. I was like, what should I listen to? So I downloaded Night Ranger's Greatest Hits album, and nice. I downloaded Hole in the Sun, which was the studio album that they had last put out, thinking, "Oh, you know, maybe they're doing some new songs off that." And as it turns out, I've yet to ever play a song live with Night Ranger from that album. But you never know. There's some good music on there. Maybe eventually. Anyway, so I'm in the van, doing van tours with Garage Mahal, and I'm like just sitting there with my earphones in, like not telling anybody.
Yeah.
I didn't tell anybody anything about this. You know, I just like checking out the music and. So I got back and the first thing we did was, I still remember the very first time I, went to meet the guys, and it was, I met, Kelly and I met Brad, and it was just the four of us that day with Jack and myself. And we were just jamming, working out, arrangement for one of the songs for Somewhere in California. And I remember that night just feeling like whatever happens with this band. That was fun. That was a lot more fun than I realized it was going to be. That was a great experience. And from there, we ended up Jack just kept being like, "Hey, just come over to the studio." So I was hanging out at the studio most of the time, and sometimes laying down keyboard tracks, sometimes just being there supporting others while they were laying down their tracks.
Sure.
So I ended up joining the band, and the very first show that we were going to play is a casino out in Sacramento, which is driving distance for me. So it was actually wonderful, like a first show to kind of get my toes in the water and still kind of feeling like I'm playing a local show. So I showed up and played the show, And I remember having the same feeling at the end of the night, like, wow, that was so much more fun.
Yeah.
So much more fun than I even realized it was going to be. That was a blast. And so I loaded up my car and I was going to drive back home. And I got a text from one of the crew guys saying, hey, we're all eating in the diner or the casino. If you want to join us for a little food before you make the drive. And I was like, sure, yeah. So I parked my car and I walked inside and I was looking at the signs to figure out, you know, all right, where am I going? Where's this diner at? And a couple people walked up and said, hey, great show. Can we get a picture with you? And I was like, sure, yeah. And we take a picture. And then a couple more people were like, hey, great show. Can we get a picture? And
nice.
So I take a few pictures and then I looked around me and I realized that like I was completely encircled with people. But they were all smiling.
Yeah.
They were all smiling. I was like, okay, this is very different. And then a security guy came over and said, would you like an escort? And I said, yeah, I guess so.
Sure.
So that was kind of my introduction into, okay, yeah, my life has changed. Things are different.
Yeah.
And yeah, my second show was opening for Journey in Mexico City.
Wow.
At an arena. So yeah.
Wow. And
jumped right in at that point.
And that's just it, to go from playing small house gigs to playing mid-sized festivals, that kind of stuff, in the jam band scene, you know, a couple few thousand people to high arena. This fits like 20,000 people in it now. What has that journey been like for you to have now played in front of millions and millions of people, to have been on, you know, albums with Night Ranger, things like that?
Well, as far as for playing for more people, I think it's an interesting phenomenon, like playing in an amphitheater or an arena is amazing. I've never played in a stadium. I can only imagine, but
sure.
Played plenty of amphitheaters and arenas and yeah, it's amazing. And like hearing the roar of the crowd and seeing the lights and yeah, it's an amazing feeling being up there and it's incredible. But in a way it's like you do lose something that from the club experience. But when you're playing on the stage at a club, it's like you're really there with everybody and everybody's really there with you. And you look out into the crowd and you're making eye contact with people and everybody's there really rocking out together. It can feel a little bit more sterile as you're on a stage further away from people. It can kind of feel like, okay, we're over here kind of doing this and they're all kind of out there doing that.
Sure. The synergy doesn't necessarily cross the barrier the way it does when you're a foot above them, you know? Like when you're just on a raised platform that's a foot instead of like, we're on a 20-foot high stage, everybody. How you doing? You know, like once you get raised up above them and separated by a barrier of security, it absolutely changes that vibe. Even as an audio engineer, it changes that vibe. Because like that's how I knew my band was in flow. Like I felt the synergy coming from stage through the crowd. Of my venue,
right on
that kind of stuff.
Excellent.
And
yeah, it's so being the sound engineer. You have such a crucial role to play.
It's
for whatever anybody's doing up on stage, they're at your mercy.
Well, much like I said, it's literally being a member of the band. You know, it's kind of like you're wearing a producer hat. And yeah, man, if you don't do a good job when you've had two beers, I am not letting you drink before you hit stage. We can drink all night after if you want. But if you get sloppy on stage and then you don't sound good, that's all of us. Like,
right.
You know, and it really is that teamwork mentality, that teamwork makes the dream work. We all have to kind of be pulling equally to get our horse to the end game. And especially whenever you're talking about large shows, the size shows that you're playing now with Night Ranger, that the logistics of that especially come into play. How long it takes to be able to set up your rig, everything else. How long it takes to do sound check. How much time you have between things. The game changes completely.
Yeah, well, we're, you know, fortunate to have an incredible crew, a really, really incredible crew. So it's right. I'm not actually up there loading up my keyboards and setting them up on stage. And that's also something that I never want to take for granted. I remember back when I was still in Chicago, and I was doing a steady Sunday night for a while with a drummer named Steve Gillis. And at the time, he was in the band Filter.
Oh yeah, those guys. Oh yeah, I loved Filter.
Yeah, I remember. I remember one night we were playing our Sunday night gig, and there's, you know, maybe 50 people there at the most. And he's telling us about like how the night before he was playing at Foxborough Stadium for, you know, however many thousands of people.
Yeah.
And I was like, how do you go from playing Foxborough last night to playing here tonight and still keep the energy up? And he was like, in certain ways, you know, this is really the musically rewarding experience for me.
Yeah.
He didn't say in a way that was bashing Filter, but saying it in a way that was really like, hey, you know, this one's fun.
Is
anything.
That one's work. This one's always fun. You know, like, yeah, it is really a different mentality once you start hitting that level of things. And you kind of do have to have a mentality switch because you've got to exude something a little bit different when you're in a space that large. And a lot of come down to gear. It does come down to gear you're working with. You know, you can't necessarily be bumping around with like a Roland 5 input keyboard amp anymore. you know, things start changing rapidly, and that's a whole snowball that happens when you start stepping into that world. And what is that experience and that change been like for you to start doing that, to start, I guess kind of changing the way you think about things, the way that they're set up, the way that your rig runs, things like that, to know that instead of you having to set it up in 30 minutes, sure, you have a couple of guys setting up your rig and everything, but the logistics of how you've arranged things, how you have things patched together, that kind of stuff.
Sure, yeah. Actually, when I first started with the band, I was using a laptop computer up on stage.
Yeah,
and I've actually gone in the opposite direction most people have. I started with the laptop, and now I'm not dealing with any kind of computer at all.
I've got a
Yamaha Motif and a Hammond SK1, and
that's
basically all I got. A few pedals, and that's it. I was having so many issues.
Yeah.
Granted, part of it was the platform that I had chosen, literally summer of 2011, months after I've programmed the entire show on Native Instruments Core, it was called, and they decided to discontinue it that year.
Yeah.
And I don't blame them for doing so. I think I understand why they did. But it was just every night I was so much of my mental energy was going toward like, all right, make sure I change this patch on time, and oh, that MIDI just like screwed up, and oh, it's like I was just like so keyed into the technical elements of things that I that's where most of my mental resources were going.
Yeah.
And I had one night where the thing just crashed and I ended up, made it through the show. But I was like, that's it. I'm not putting myself through that again.
Yeah.
I'm not putting this band through that again.
Yeah. That's the big, you can't put the show through.
Reprogrammed everything on the motif and I'm super happy.
And what's interesting that you bring that up. I myself was an analog engineer, been forced into the digital world. But even to this day, my DAW, my digital audio workstation that I use in my studio, I use like a big analog 4-track. I do not mix inside the box. All my effects are outboard. All of my synthesizers I use are outboard synthesizers, like rack mount stuff. I'm a huge Emu freak. I love Emu because I make a lot of electronic textural stuff, things like that. But I see so many people leaning on the computer live, and even nowadays in the professional sound world, like, I can't tell you the number of live corporate gigs I've been at where the board just freezes up. And it's like, you know, if we had an analog board, you could just patch that over to the next channel and turn it up and just keep going. I mean, millions of dollars right. refunded to clients because the digital console just locked up and it took 15 minutes to reboot it, you know? And it's a chance that we take when we start truly. It's great to use this stuff in a studio environment where it's in a controlled mm-hmm. space, stuff like that. But once it starts living on the road, everything else, and you're talking about time constraints, you're talking about latency issues between your MIDI, your computer, things start happening. Good Lord for Finn that you get a computer virus or something. There goes a whole show. You know, if you mm-hmm. wake up, a computer's kind of like a car. Some days you just wake up and they don't turn on. What then? And I've always been a big proponent whenever I worked with bands of use things you can buy locally. So to hear the fact that you're using stuff like a Yamaha Motif, stuff like that, like even with pedals, I love Strymans. They're beautiful. They're amazing. But if you're out on the road, will you be able to just walk into your local guitar center in Poughkeepsie and buy a Stryman? You know, that's the question. If that is key, to your sound and tone, you really need to find something that you can readily get a hold of, unless you've got a major vendor that you're attached to that can just overnight it to you. You know what I mean?
Those situations are few and far between these days.
They are mm-hmm. not those agreements with artists and companies are because a lot of stuff is not necessarily made by the company. It's a parent company now, and they have distribution partnerships and assembly partnerships, all kinds of stuff. A lot of that opportunity for musicians for sponsorships and stuff has disappeared. Which is sad because it's kind of stifled a lot of this, like, hey, this isn't quality enough to be on the road, you know? So we've ended up with a lot more, I think, consumer grade products starting to enter into the professional realm, that kind of stuff because of that. And it's a good thing. It's a good thing. It's a bad thing. Point. Like the tagline for this show used to be where -10 was a number to be desired. and that's just because, hey man, if it's a line level machine that gets you the sound you're looking for, put it in line, get it. You know, if that's the unique sound you're looking for, use the gear you need to use to get it done. And the fact that you've gone back the hard gear route instead of going mixing your sound in the software and sure having an infinite panoply of things you can do at your fingertips, but at the same time, sacrificing that rock solid, I hit a power button and it turns on performance.
Exactly. Yeah, it just became a matter of priority. Mm-hmm. Because, when I was first programming the show and all that, you know, my focus was, hey, I want to sound the best I can. And the way to do that is to use the laptop. That's going to be my path toward really having the best tones for every tone.
Yeah.
And but by the time I made the switch, I realized, you know what, there's something more important, and that's reliability.
Yeah.
It's like reliability really is the number one thing. So it's like if I'm using a piano patch that doesn't have as long of samples and as many samples recorded. And, you know, yeah, I can tell the difference when I'm playing Sister Christian, but I'm playing the Motif piano instead of playing one of my favorites in the computer. But is that worth the reliability issue where I just know I've got it there? I don't have to worry. I can really just be in the music and in the moment with the performance. So, yeah, I think the reliability finally outweighed it for me. But whatever improvements I could get in tone, and really that's not at all to bash the Yamaha Motif.
It is the
keyboard to use with Night Ranger. I love it.
It is one of the most versatile keyboards out there, hands down. That, you know, maybe a Nord something along those lines, depending on why. I know a lot of jam bands that use the Nord because they don't have access to a Hammond like you do.
You hit it right on the head. Like if I'm going out to play with a jam band, there's no keyboard I would rather have on stage than a Nord.
Yeah, a Nord and a Motion sound rig. It's all you need. You'll be able to do everything. You don't have to carry Leslie with you. Like those little Motion sound rigs are really, really cool stuff. They give you
the Nords are so immediate with
it. They are.
It's like they invite you to improvise in the moment. It's like here's your buttons for your virtual stomp boxes. And it's so immediate. It's so intuitively right there, changing your sounds in the moment. Yeah, the design of the keyboard really encourages that.
It does.
The design of the Motif really encourages, like, hey, make your setup as crazy as you want. Get all these elements going and a performance and layers and splits. And then you can save that and you can recall it and get exactly what you need right at that point.
Yeah.
And that's what I need for Night Ranger. It's like there's not the improvisation of like, maybe right now I'll like go, you know, play this other part that's just coming into my head. You know, try this sound and this, you know, Night Ranger isn't that kind of thing.
No. It's very stylized.
I know what notes I'm going to play.
Yeah.
I know what the sound should sound like.
Yeah. Yeah. Precisely. It's not like, yeah, I'm going to split my keyboard now and have a clavichord on one side and a Hammond on the other. You know, that's not necessarily what you're doing in that situation, which is why a Motif, it's a great one where when you're dialing in static sounds, scenes, things like that, where it's like, we're going to this track right now. Boom, boom, done. like two buttons, you're there.
I got some excellent advice too.
What's that?
Joining Night Ranger from Joel Hoekstra, who's no longer with Night Ranger. He plays with Whitesnake now.
Yeah.
But he said, "Hey, I know you're coming from the jam band world, and it's all about improvisation. And Night Ranger is all about execution."
That's right.
And that's always stayed with me. I know what the parts are. Can I consistently every night, like, you know, really, really play them?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's just it, you know, and that's what it's different when you're a fan of a band like the Grateful Dead and you understand that you're going to hear a song in a different version of that every single night because that's what they are.
That's what keeps people coming back with their tape machines every night.
Yeah, precisely. But when you are a stylized band like that, it is all about execution. It's all about precision and recalling that moment and that memory for people, you know, and really doing justice to what they fell in love with, you know. It really does become more about that moment for the fans out there than it does for the moment that we're all kind of taking part in, you know, like with jam bands, it's very much about that moment on stage and everybody else gets to enjoy it. Welcome to the fun, everyone, you know? When you're up on stage performing things like Night Ranger, Styx, that kind of stuff where it's highly stylized, it is about performing it the way people remember it being performed, at least as close as possible. You know, you may up tempo it, down tempo it a little bit to change things up for yourself, but it's about execution.
Right. I think you hit it on the head there too. It's my perception of people who come to see a band like Night Ranger, for the most part, you know, not to do any general stereotypes at all, but for the most part, I think it really opened my eyes when I read about this study where they were studying people's brain chemistry when they heard music that they had heard at an earlier part of their life, and their brain chemistry actually changed to mimic what that looked like when they were young. Once I read that, I was like, that's what people are buying when they buy a ticket. Like, where else can you go to feel like legit feel young again?
That's
like
right.
From within your own brain, feel young again, and to be able to be doing it with, you know, a bunch of other people, and you're all sharing this experience. Yeah. Where else can you get that?
Yeah. Exactly. And it's interesting you bring that up because, yeah, I read the same study. It was a brain plasticity study done on Alzheimer's patients showing the fact that using music actively helps them remember things. You know, mm-hmm. because yes. Yeah, it brings up moments that are tied to emotion. That uh-huh. It's not yeah. necessarily a rote memory like, hey, John, they remember a place, being somewhere, doing something, and then they remember John because they remembered these other things. So it's really interesting how deep music moves us. And it really is the universal language. What has it been like for you to see these audiences all over the world listening to this music and reliving these moments? Because some of these places, you know, like Berlin, things like that, Eastern Europe, they didn't get this music till after we listened to it. A lot of it was underground, stuff like that. So what has it been like for you to kind of experience those other audiences' enjoyment? What's that like?
Well, we just got back from Japan. We were there in October and that was actually, I think, my fourth time now going over with Night Ranger. And, Japanese are completely, wow.
Yeah.
They're playing a... I would recommend to any musicians listening, if you ever get a gig opportunity to go play in Japan, take it. There's nothing like playing for the audiences. It's like we'll play a song and there'll be like crazy cheering, and then as soon as Jack will start talking, it's like silence, and it's just the whole place is just silent because everybody is respectfully listening to what he has to say, and
wow.
And then it's like we'll start the next song and I'll see like everybody's head banging in the same way all together, and they've got their arms up in the air and they're all singing, and it's incredible. Absolutely incredible. Yeah. As far as Berlin, you know, I've never actually Ooh. Been to Berlin.
Okay.
Now that I think about it.
Okay.
Yeah. And Night Ranger's only done, been to Germany once since I've been in the band. And that was right when we started in 2011. But I remember having an incredibly wonderful experience getting a chance to meet the people out there who were into the band. And yeah, I kind of wasn't able to appreciate it yet because it was right when I joined, and it was such a whirlwind of going to Mexico, to going to Japan, straight over to Europe, and,
wow.
and then back over here touring with Journey for 4 months. But yeah, looking back, it's cool looking back at it, how fun that was getting a chance to tour around Germany. Yeah, really enjoyed it.
Yeah, and you know, with that in mind, what are you looking forward to? You know, with all of this in your career past, what is in your career path right now? You know, like are you personally working? Because I love what you do. I follow you on Facebook. If you enjoy synthesizer
Thank you.
Work, folks, go follow him on Facebook. Oh my Lord, he puts out some of the coolest videos of him playing his Moog and stuff like that. It is phenomenal. When is Night Ranger? What's next for Night Ranger? What can we look for from you guys?
There's something will be announced soon.
Okay. Yeah, understandable.
But
understandable.
I can say that 2020 looks to be a very exciting year for us.
Good. Very, very glad
yeah,
to hear
sure.
that. And where can everybody go to find out more about you? Where can they go to hear more music? Where can they go to keep up with the latest from Night Ranger, find out the latest tour dates, all that kind of stuff?
Sure. Well, there's nightranger.com website. And Night Ranger also has a presence on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
Okay.
So, if you're on any of those platforms and you're interested in Night Ranger, you can find it there, or just nightranger.com, or just Google Night Ranger tour dates.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time, for sharing your story, and some great advice for people trying to come up in the industry, people trying to make their bones as a musician, you know, and kind of get themselves out there, start living their own dream via their passion. Thank you so much for that, Eric.
Oh, thank you, Chris. Really, really a pleasure being a part of this. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Oh, absolutely. I'd love to chat with you all again whenever you're getting ready to go on the road, whenever you have an album to promote, anything like that. You're always welcome to come back on the show.
Thank you. I'd love to come back on the show. Yeah.
All right.
Absolutely.
Well,
thanks.
Yeah, most definitely. Well, please do hold the line while we close things out real quick. While you are online checking out nightranger.com and all of the amazing music, make sure to stop on by the talkingsoundshow.com. That is where you can find the Talking Sound podcast. That is also where you can find all of the amazing coverage from CES 2020 that I did with our new partner, the Tech Podcast Network. We were there for a week doing all kinds of wild coverage, and go on, check that out. Make sure to stop on by podcastcadet.com, use the code TALKINGSOUND20 upon checkout, and you will save 20%. Until next time, everybody, take care of yourselves, take care of your hearing, and keep reaching for 11. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
This is Talking Sound.